The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Today's episode features two very prominent professionals who have led, and now when I say lead, very diverse and exciting lives. The first is Frank K. Wheaton, Esquire. Frank is a super prominent U.S. attorney specializing in entertainment law, developer, media specialist, and as he says, very aptly, a global citizen. But wait until you hear about his life story. The second person is Dr. Robert Jameson, PhD, and he has been a professional healthcare worker for 40 years. He's the founder of Alternative Healthcare LA, a health clinic in Los Angeles. But he too, just like Frank Wheaton, has led a very diverse and interesting life.
Please join us for part two episode with Frank Wheaton and Dr. Robert Jameson.
In 2009, I paid the price, a huge price, that could have cost me everything that I ever worked hard for in my whole entire life. I got caught up in the system. I got caught up in the system not because I was a criminal. Stephen talked about this briefly before, friendship and not reading contracts. Yes, it cost me my freedom. It cost me some disappointment. It cost me pain, anxiety, depression, PTSD, all sorts of behavioral. After all the success that I had done from the time of being published in the Memphis Business Journal, all of my accolades that I had accomplished could all wiped away. I got in a relationship with a white man from Mobile, Alabama. And I'm going to be specific because I want everybody to know that the race card ain't just started through all of my ordeals. It was back here way back with my ancestors. I just had an opportunity to get a portion of the fruit that I bit. I trusted a white man to help me open up a healthcare school and allow me an opportunity to become a training center for the American Heart Association as a CPR instructor. That gave me an opportunity to be over a center to train nurses and healthcare professionals to become that CPR instructor with me owning my own training center. In the contract, I didn't read. It's saying that I was licensed as a training site, S-I-T-E, not training center. The white man knew exactly what he was doing. He sent me a curriculum to be a training center, though the contract said a training site. Lo and behold, I took his word and started training people to become CPR instructors. He issued me DVDs to train by. He gave me a platform to burn the DVDs and CDs to train by. He issued me the reading curriculum to teach by-step models. I paid for that course. I paid for the supplies. I also charged people money to train them. And the license was bogus.
Wow.
That was bogus because I wasn't a legitimate training center. I was a training site. I got caught up in the system.
I don't even want to ask what they did.
They incarcerated me. They labeled me as a scam artist and a crook. But the paper trail showed different. The paper trail, the curriculum, so that I was authorized to train this program, which was sanctioned and licensed through him. The payment that each person paid me, the paper trail through PayPal showed that I paid him, okay? The fine print visibly said that I was a training site. If I had read that contract, I could have corrected that issue. I had a deceptive business practice charge as a healthcare professional. I had four indictments that came at me as felony charges for something that I was a victim of. I go through the process. The district attorney told me, said, Robert, we know that you're innocent, but you got to go through the process. That I'm innocent, but I got to go through the process. I had to go downtown and take a picture of my face mug all over the news, right?
Of course.
Big article in the newspaper, all because of that one mistake. Okay, as a indictment came in, they're going to get really juicy. And I was reluctant to go through this process with Stephen. I went to court, that pre-trial situation. They scheduled me to come back in from an indictment hearing like a year later. At that time, I was going through this separation divorce with my ex-wife. The indictment letter went to my previous address with the court date to go in and rectify this whole thing and clear my name. My ex-wife concealed the letter of the court hearing. It was supposed to be May the 9th, 2010. Keep in mind, I'm a healthcare professional. I'm not with my ex-wife. We're separated. I get a call on May the 9th at noontime. I'm here in Southern California. That's when I met Dr. Jackson, Stephen. But anyway, it was saying like, Dad, you all over the news, man. You're supposed to have been in court today. The judge said you are a fugitive. You are on the run. All this drama going on while I'm out here in California trying to get everything started to enhance my future. I had to fly back the next morning to go back in and turn myself in after being published all over the news for something I was not even aware of. I went to court. I didn't go straight to my ex-wife because I was no longer there, but I went to my attorney's office. He took me to the district attorney office to reschedule. I had to show proof that I was in California. I had to show proof that I applied for business license, that I was not aware of this indictment letter going to my resident. At the hearing the next morning, the judge said, Mr. James, either your ex-wife, she's trying to throw you under the jail cell, or she got something really bad against you, but we mailed you two letters, not just one. We mailed you two because sometimes inmates, they don't get their letter for court, so we want to make sure we had the correct address. Long story short, I went to court, justified my living in California. The judge reinstated my bond. I was able to have another hearing to answer to that indictment. Going through the process of the court situation, they dropped all these bogus charges against me, but one charge, that was a guilty plea. I didn't know anything about the system. I never been in jail in my life. I never been in trouble in my life. I did a plea bargain for probation for 4 years. I had an up-and-coming clinic that I'm trying to open up in California. I had a practice in Memphis still that I was working at called Intervening Healthcare. The judge gave me 4-year probation for a crime that I was a victim of. I couldn't resume my life like that. The moment I go to work in Arkansas, going across the state line, I've been violating my probation. I would have faced the police, the probation office, I would have been in violation. So I thought about it that week and I said, I can't do this because the moment I started interviewing people for employment in Memphis, people saw me all over the news. I got a whole thing of squad cars coming at me as a scam artist. So I called my attorney. I said, I got to get off this probation. And lo and behold, that very same day that I called my attorney, people were saying that I was out here trying to do the same thing I got in trouble with. So therefore, my attorney said, the only way you can put this behind you, I'll call Ed. He's the district attorney. We can just get back your probation. We can work out a deal with you. We can put you on a work release program. You can go to the correction facility. You can do your time. And when you get out, you can go back to your normal life. The news that day said, Robert Jameson appeared in court this morning. The district attorney dropped all the charges. He did a plea bargain for deceptive business practice, and he's on 4-year probation. I said, nope, that is not true. I was in court this morning while you out here defaming my name about things that I didn't do. I didn't miss my court date. Secondly, I surrendered my probation. They gave me 14 months on a work release program. All I had to do was go into the facility, which was a correction facility, sleep at night and let them take me to work the next morning, pick me up and take me back the next evening. I did that for 14 months. After I got out for those 14 months, I was able to resume my medical career and leave a normal life. But on top of that, I tried to sue them. Number one, for listen to what I'm saying, defamation of character, number one, because the news, whoever wrote that story, said that I missed a court, which I didn't miss a court. Secondly, I got an opportunity to see all the corruption that was going on into the correction facility. And as documentation showed that I documented everything that happened to me thoroughly from the beginning to the end of time, anything that happened to me. There was other inmates watching me as I did all my documentation on an affidavit that everything that I was doing was sworn to be the truth. I wrote all that stuff up while I was incarcerated. When I was got discharged from that institution, I went straight down to the Shelby County District Attorney office and said, these are all the things that you guys put me through while I was locked up. It's more corruption inside this facility than it is out here in these streets. I said, the contraband is coming from the officer that I've witnessed bringing that stuff in. You know what I mean? The infraction they were laying down on innocent inmates because they want to expand their time. I saw them make up stories so their time can be 12 and 13 months, turn into 3 to 4 years. I went nose to nose with the director of the correction facility, and I wrote letters to the warden. All this stuff was documented, and how I was able to get this stuff out to the public, I would put it in my booth, in my shoe sock, as I was going out in the morning, and I was sending stuff to the ACLU, to the Department of Justice, so everybody that played a part of me being incarcerated for a crime that I did not commit. I went through a lot to get to where I am. So I wrote this book called The Turning Point, including the lawsuit that I dropped because I didn't want to keep going back and forth to Memphis. It's in this book. It's called The Turning Point, Giving First-Time Low-Level Felon Offenders a Second Chance. Because having a felon on your record should not be the end of the world. A lot of inmates are not aware that they still can get back in civilization and become successful in your own endeavors. I went through a lot to get to where I am. So even though everything that I went through has got expunged now, my indictment wasn't medical related. It was a stupid mistake that I made. I could have went in and went back after the guy that got me into this situation. But listen, God made me to become a powerful Black man. You know what I mean? And like I tell everybody, education, God gave it to me. You did. I worked hard to achieve for my accomplishment. So therefore, if God gave it to me once, he can give it to me again. During my third month incarceration, I got a divorce letter while I was incarcerated. My ex-wife, she filed for a divorce. She tried to wipe out my bank account while I was incarcerated. She tried to take everything to keep for herself while I was incarcerated. I had to hire a divorce attorney, and the only way I was able to do that was to work this whole system through my mother before she expired. My mother had stage 4 lung cancer and was living from day to day. I prayed to God that he kept her alive until I got out. I called her oncologist and I told him, as a medical professional, I need you to put my mom on the lowest dose of chemotherapy and do CAT scan randomly to keep an eye on this tumor so I can go in and handle what I need to handle and pray to God that she didn't die while I was incarcerated. As a professional, the doctors knew me. They knew that I was innocent. It's amazing that when I was going through my process, some of my colleagues that I worked with had my back. Some of the physicians spoke on my character. The judge knew my character. I had a lot of people to support me throughout the process, but my ex-wife had motives. The moment I turned myself in to get off probation, she told me she's going to take care of all the bill for me. She had access to my bank account, access to everything. And throughout the process, while I was defenseless, at the lowest point in my life, she tried to take everything from me.
Now, let me ask you a question, because at some point I have to decide whether I'm going to edit some of this out in terms of whether there is any legal ramifications. We have a lawyer right here.
Well, Robert's brilliance has already been demonstrated. Like me, when I almost named the guys who were my bosses at NBC, I decided not to, whether they are living or not. Robert profoundly and brilliantly did not name any names, but only told of the circumstances. So as long as it's true, he has the best defense of all.
Then this would be included in the broadcast. Yeah. Okay. Now, yeah. Frank, you
in New York.
And then you go back to Los Angeles.
Why? I'll tell you why. When I was walking up and down Madison Avenue, working for all the advertisers and having the best success ratio, it's like a batter's average. Only Ted Williams hit 400. But other batters who are great baseball players, they bat high twos, 300s. That means 3 out of every 10 at bats result in hits. I hit or got 7 out of 10 commercial auditions that I went on. Phenomenal. I was walking down the street one day and I saw one of my dear friends who's now in his 80s. He was 53 years old at the time. And I looked at him and I said, I don't want to be 53 looking for my next commercial. So fortunately, a television series brought me back to California at the time, Counterattack Crime in America with George Kennedy. and it starred George, myself. It was like a 60 Minutes. In fact, it was on opposite 60 Minutes, which is why it probably 6 weeks. But it was a great show. It was the first of the reality-based television shows. George Kennedy would serve as an in-studio host, and Frank Wheaton and others would report crimes in faraway cities. Frank Wheaton is on Long Island with the 45 caliber thief. Then I do a 10-minute on-air piece with ABC, which is what it was on. After the TV series, of which the great and late Ivan Dixon directed the last episode, God bless Mr. Dixon, I began to work episodic television, Greatest American Hero, Hardcastle and McCormick, shows like that. And then I got on in a series recurring role on Matlock. So while I was doing Matlock, I said, you know what? I was reading the paper one day in my dressing room, which was next to Andy Griffiths. I said, come go to law school. So that's exactly what I did. I went to law school, began to study my law books while I was working the show. I wound up working the show about two and a half years, 15 episodes as the recurring bailiff in the show. Every now and then I'd have some interaction with Andy. I saw Andy treat and or mistreat several people of color, but he never mistreated me. But I saw it. First day I met Andy, like any other all-American kid who knew the theme song of the Andy Griffiths Show, I ran up to him and said, Mr. Griffiths, can I have a photograph with you? And he said, sure, kid. And he took a photograph with me. And one of the production assistants said to me, you're lucky. Andy typically fires people when they do that. So don't ever do it again. I saw people come and go, especially African-Americans. But Andy never bothered me for some reason. And my trailer was next to his. And to this day, 20, 25 years later, I still get residual checks from Matlock. So got one uncashed now. I've been very fortunate. I went to law school, knew I would come out of law school representing professional athletes, free agents. First it was free agents. And then I realized there were more agents than there were athletes. I said, what can I do to distinguish myself from all the other agents? So I thought about, created, and developed something that I thought would involve the greatest professional athlete ever, and it would not infringe on his contracts. All this happened in my mother's home, which is why the greatness, Robert, as you feel, is still there for my mother. Every time the name Michael Jordan came up in my mind. So I created, developed, and produced for television, and sold it to television, the first Michael Jordan Celebrity Golf Classic. Brought everybody in, from Governor Schwarzenegger to Jack Lemmon to Julius Erving, with whom I still play golf to this day. It was just a fantastic affair. And held down at La Costa in Carlsbad, California, spectacular resort. And we raised $1 million for the United Negro College Fund in one weekend. Wow. That got good to me. We then created, thank you, we then created World's Fastest Athlete, with my former partner, Scott Savloff, who actually came up with the concept, but I helped refine it, develop it, and executive produce it with Jim Spence, who ran ABC Sports for 25 years. So we sold World's Fastest Athlete with Carl Lewis, Eric Dickerson, Ron Brown, Daryl Green, all the superstars of Ricky Henderson, and we taped it, filmed it in the at the University of Hawaii, where my daughter flew just today. That show came on in the middle of the Kentucky Derby, so it didn't have a chance for a recurring, although we did have an option for it. Then we did Sports Greats one-on-one with David Hartman, who created Good Morning America. I taped the pilot with Jim Brown and Angela Wilder, who was James Worthy's first, Worthy's wife.
Oh,
and
I remember Angela. Yeah, we had a lunch together one day.
Okay, she created that show, and we executive produced it for ABC's Wide World of Sports, for ESPN, I'm sorry. So several of those, six, half dozen of those, and dozens of live stage events from about 12 Bob Beamon Celebrity Golf Classics in Southern Florida, all sorts of James Worthy All-Star Basketball Clinics in Compton for 1,000 kids every year. One of my most treasured accomplishments, the great Michael Milken, or infamous Michael Milken, however you want to look at it. But he did part of his community service with me and the kids of Compton, taught them things about Mike's Math Club and just little tricks about how to do math that has made him famous. And also he's head of CapCure, which is one of the leading prostate cancer study centers in the world now. So dozens of shows like that. Then, of course, I went back into representing elected officials, Mayor Omar Bradley being one, along with the whole city council, but also some very influential and confidential elected senators and congresspersons that I don't name names for their own protection. And then
your most famous client that you had lately.
Prince.
I was thinking before Prince.
I know who you're thinking of. It's funny that somebody asked me this, Stephen, just recently. And there have been a couple of people who wanted to do books and have talked with me for a year plus, a couple of hours a week, a very famous book writer who's written several number one books in America. I met in Qatar, and he was listening to my story that I was telling somebody else. He said, I want to do a book about you. And I said, really? Yeah. He said, about you. And just like you asked me, Stephen, I said, when I represented Bob Beeman, I don't want to hear about it. When I did this for Michael Jordan, I don't want to hear about Michael Jordan. When I did, he said, about you. And it was so very cathartic, as I'm sure Roberts was during the making of his book. I talked to him for 15 months, and he is the actual author behind the book 9-1-1 and the true story behind the World Trade Center disaster. Approached me to write a book about this kid from Compton who had been able to somehow slip through the pickets and the fence and experience some wonderful things throughout this life. We talked for 15 months, and when we got to the last chapter, which the whole thing was so cathartic, I said, Robert, I need to stop right now because I'm not finished. I want to write the last chapter of my life the way I want it to go. And I've been fortunate enough to dream about what I want it to become and then go after it and realize it. In later life, people stopped believing. Sometimes even my wife didn't really believe in my dreams as I did. In fact, that was a contention of our marriage. She said it was all about what my dreams. I still have dreams. I'm not telling you not to do your dreams. I just have my dreams and I know how to focus on them. And sometimes it takes longer than otherwise. I told Daniel that I needed to wait just a little while longer. Not that money is a measure, but Dr. Dre was the first Black billionaire from Compton. I may not be the first, but I may be the second if I keep living and working hard. Because when I did this case that you're asking about, Stephen, what I learned from the cases that came about afterwards is so phenomenal. I learned something about generational wealth. And there are generational wealth tax skipping clauses that you can create in your will or trust, Robert, so that your immediate legacy does not have to pay taxes on that income, but it skips a generation. I saw this when and after the case that Stephen is talking about is my representing the discovered African-American daughter of the late Senator Strom Thurmond, who was one of the most staunchest racists reflected in the history of United States politics. Wow. He was the staunch segregationist from South Carolina, as I refer to him. But because I know the real story behind that story, even though we had a New York Times bestselling book called Dear Senator, written by William Stadium in the preface, William Stadium tells about how this kid from Compton championed this entire story and saved Essie May from being a footnote in history to becoming an important part of history, as she was. Essie Mae Washington Williams was born in 1925 to the maid of the late Senator Strom Thurmond. Many people thought it was statutory rape or rape because she was only 14, but in those days and time, it was not so. I'll just put it like that. And she didn't come out until she was 78 years old. And a friend of mine, whose her daughter was his girlfriend in junior high school, she was about to give up. And she had gone to lawyers and who wanted $15,000 to contest the will or $10,000 to contest the genetics. She came to me and she said, so Mr. Whedon, how much will it cost? I said, nothing. So she was shocked. She said, what do you mean nothing? I understood the entertainment value. And I knew that we could make money as an overflow of the entertainment value. You don't make money from news shows of integrity, like Today, Good Morning America, or 60 Minutes. You don't make money on those, but you make money as a result of being on those shows. And that's exactly what we did. Dan Rather of 60 Minutes called me and said, Frank, anything you want, we will provide. If you want to bring somebody, bring them. So I brought one of my best friends who served as the medical assistant, stayed at the Waldorf Astoria, whatever we wanted. Dan said, we want this show first on nighttime television.
Wow.
The Today Show said, we want this show first on morning television. And when I say they were scampering as though I had won an Academy Award or something, that's how they were all over us, because right. This story was phenomenal at that time. Of all people, Strom Thurmond had a black daughter. Can't be. Say it ain't be, Nelly. But it was. And it was true. And we had her. And Essie Mae, in all of her reverence, was just as beautiful and glorious and regal as you would want her to be. Beautiful. You look at the cover of the book, she looks just like Strom, except she's of your complexion, Robert, but features just like Strom's. You know what I'm saying? It was a wonderful time, wonderful, yeah. Wonderful story. And we maximized it. Some other things internally happened that I think some of the children realized later that they shouldn't have interfered or gotten involved, because sometimes when it's your own, you think you have learned enough to be a lawyer or a manager or whatever too soon. And yeah. Just like a doctor, you don't treat yourself. Or a lawyer, you don't represent yourself. Right. You got a fool for a client. All of those things happened that interfered with it. But one of them in particular had the respect and for to call me when Essie Mae passed away and ask that I deliver the eulogy and the tribute. And I sat right next to Paul Thurmond, one of Strom's sons. And that's the story behind the story that hasn't been told yet. The story from my perspective and not right. The story yeah. That was created for the book. Right. And so the story behind my story is are the nights that I spent in the Thurmond households, how Essie Mae was actually supported from 1945. People don't realize she was supported way back then when she went to college. Anybody who was at South Carolina State University at that time, they saw Strom there every week, every month, because he was there supporting his daughter. But of course, Strom had to say what he said for his constituents so that they would continue to believe that he was a staunch segregationist and racist that he wanted, when he would say, we don't want Negroes in our swimming pool. But in practice, he took care of his daughter.
Wow.
Her whole life. And that's the story behind the story. Not so much of a secret anymore. So outside of that, the fallout began. The sons and daughters of presidents, and remember, these are not all black people that were calling me, but white people that were calling, who would see me on 60 Minutes or Today or Good Morning America or any of the shows talking about this, wanting me to represent their interests. And one of the bigger ones that I did, I can't say whom because of the confidentiality clauses, but one of those is a household name. You use the product almost every day. And he has four children who look just like him and they do his television commercials. But this other child who was born before them looks more like him than they do. And she was conceived when her mom and him went to Catalina Island for their prom or after date or whatever. And the bottom line is people like that and others came to me, children of presidents, Bill Clinton's purported sons, family. People came to me thinking that I could solve their lifelong issues with their parents. Very famous individuals that, of course, I'm not at liberty to say. Even one of the former presidents whose children are still living now, I keep waiting for them to come forward. They have actual mementos, shirts with the former president's initials engraved. Just interesting stuff that I've been privileged to hear. By the way, Robert, that's where I learned about the generational tax-skipping clauses of sophisticated trusts. Where would a kid from Compton ever see that or learn about that? You don't learn about that in law school necessarily, but I saw it in practice, and I saw this is how they did it. And so when they sent one of their firebrand rookies out to defend against me, I knew I had a strong case. I told him to go back to the woodshed. You're not ready yet. Send me somebody who's ready to settle this deal. They sent the next guy. Same thing. So then they sent the final guy, who was this $750, $1,000 an hour tobacco lawyer who represented their family. And I tell you, his understanding of the law was so sophisticated and so beautiful that I hired one of my boys that went to Stanford before he did and went to Harvard before he did.
Oh, wow.
Then I hired my cousin who went to Harvard after he did so he could cover me. I said, you guys cover the beautiful sophistication and yin and yang of the law with its finest points, because I didn't want them to beat me up on technicalities, because I knew I had the substance of the story and the law of the story on my side. And against my own client's wishes, she insisted on a DNA test. And I said, that's just a charade, a circus. It's all fixed. Do you think the chain of custody is not going to be broken by clients of this vast wealth? But she insisted. My first demand was for $1 billion. They didn't flinch. The next day or two after we settled, I saw their wealth in Forbes magazine at about 14, 15, probably 20 billion net at that time. And this is 10 years ago. It's probably 50, 60, 100 billion now. But how they did it is even more sophisticated. But my client, I think, was a little afraid that she wouldn't get anything if she took a chance. So we had a straw vote, and the guy I had hired before, he voted with her so he could get paid. And my cousin, of course, faded with me because it was the right thing to do. But I insisted that, you know, she hold out because she could get a lot more if that's what she wanted, her rightful deserve. But she got afraid. Years later, she called me and told me, she said, you were right. You didn't need these other people to help settle this case. You knew enough about the case yourself. And I probably should have held out a little longer. But I said, I can't gamble with your money. That's your decision. But all those kind of interesting cases came about as a result.
Oh, wow.
I was going to say, this is going to be a two-parter.
I've been listening to Dr. Jameson's story like it was my own. I enjoyed it tremendously, Dr. Jameson.
I appreciate that.
Now, back to Dr. Jameson. Since that time, since you got out of the legal difficulties that you were in, how have you moved forward?
First and foremost, I had to forgive myself for being so stupid and not reading between the lines. Secondly, I had to go back and forgive my ex-wife for treating me the way that she did prior to me being discharged. But I also had to point the finger at me, myself, for me to move forward to be where I am today, because I did so much dirt toward her. And then I finally realized that if it had been me, I would try to take the brother down too. You know what I mean? Because my past history was scandalous. As a young guy working in surgery, making all this money, ripping around the streets, disrespecting my wife, disrespecting my home by staying out all night long, I had to come to a conclusion that I had to forgive myself for doing the thing that I did to her. So I was able to get past that. First and foremost, I pray to God that he give me the strength and ability to build what he once gave me for doing the thing that I did to cause me to lose everything. But after he took my mother away from me, that was an eye-opener. But I had to praise him for keeping her on this side of the earth until I was able to get out of that institution and resume my life. But I wanted to change myself in 2012, before 2013 arrived. I prayed to God for a whole hour until I blew every piece of snot boogers out my nose and dropped every tear that I needed to drop for me to feel his spirit, for him to give me the comfortability, knowing that everything is going to be okay. My mother's up in heaven with him. I have no more worries. My divorce is finna be finalized. He told me in spirit, the money that she's asking for is not yours. Give it back. I gave it to you once. I can give it to you again. The thing that you have prayed and confessed to, I forgive you. And I'm willing to put you back in a position where you're able to move on with your life and put the past behind you. Close the book on the old chapter and open up the new chapter. January the 1st, 2013, I didn't look back. I looked forward. I didn't cry. I wasn't bitter. I wasn't angry. I focused on me. I forgave myself. I forgave my wife. I forgave everybody that did misdeed toward me, and plus what I did to them. I wiped the slate clean. First and foremost, I went to the institution. I surrendered my freedom. I wiped the slate clean. Now I'm ready to move on with my life. So I got off into thinking about how I can benefit my future with my mom as part of it. She died with stage 4 lung cancer, and I wanted to create a movement and something to shed light on what we have done together as a memorable thing for the remainder of my life. 9 years ago, I created a movement called the Together Forever Cancer Movement. I wanted to bring the community together and assist with some of these charity organizations. I adopted the American Cancer Society as one of my charity organizations. I did my first concert downtown Skid Row. And Mr. Frank, you know about Skid Row. Everybody, went to a church and did a musical fundraiser, brought the former lead singer of LTD, Andre, as one of my first artists to help develop this whole program. I've been in the music industry, Mr. Frank, for over 20 years. I currently represent the Memphis Bar Kays, the Mad Lads, the Tim Priest, Stax Records artists. Right. And putting this whole fundraising together, I was bringing a lot of the legendary artists together and putting them on the stage to people our age. So
Stax Records is a friend of mine for years.
I've been working with the Tim Priest and the Bar Kays. In fact, we just had a show this weekend, but get back to the fundraising part. Mm-hmm. I utilized the artists, the legendary artists to come and sync with me, build a platform for me to get out and tell my story about what I went through, but also embrace people that's affected by these diseases. And the Together Forever movement now has become so big out of the past 9 years. I work with all the legendary artists from old school, the Dramatics, the Manhattan, the Delphonic, the Tim Priest, the Broad Cage, Climax, Evelyn Champagne King, the whole, some of the people that you represent.
But I don't represent them, but I know who they are. Absolutely. I'm not as fortunate.
I'm on a path now where I'm able to exhibit and share the wealth and help raise money for causes. So that's been a very good beneficial opportunity for me, not only to help people in the clinic, but also help people that's going through the process. We're doing a big fundraiser right now for St. Jude Childhood Cancer on the platform, on the pay-per-view channel right now, which we're running for a whole month. And that's just to help kids affected by childhood cancer, brain cancer.
Maybe I want to represent you.
All of the things came to fruition when I was able to put my past behind me and not worry about what I've been through, but worry about where I'm going. You know what I mean? Because when God wiped the slate clean, helped me wipe the slate clean, he still keep me motivated. He energized me. He keep my brain regulated for me to create more opportunities to bring the community together to support these different organizations as we do now. So I opened up my clinic in 2013, Alternative Healthcare LA, which I'm affiliated with all the hospitals here in Southern California. I run two urgent cares now, not as a medical doctor, but as a PhD doctor, the owner of my own facility where I have medical directors and medical team that's doing all my medical work. And I'm running the practices, but I'm also doing a behavioral health clinic for mental illness because it's necessary. And a PhD doctor with a degree with the psychologist is able to formulate that avenue as well. Mm-hmm. So God gave me an opportunity to build the wealth that I once lost, but created with a different model. You know what I mean? Keeping myself as the business owner and hire specialty people to make sure that these businesses ran through medical facilities and medical staff. It was a different model with me being on the front center of everything, but delegate work to people in different specialties with different professionals and continue to grow throughout the whole entire process. So with the pay-per-view going for doing fundraisers, I'm bringing all of my colleagues together. They're making donations to this institution, St. Jude, based on the effort that we are putting together with the legendary artists.
So just out of curiosity, where are your urgent care?
Downtown Los Angeles.
Both are downtown.
One over on Vernon and Broadway. It's in the Vernon Bro building with Dr. Mm-hmm. Cardin Gill. Dr. Gill, he's a 40-year professional. You might know him because he's one of the biggest black doctors here in Southern California. Right. And the other location is at 122 East Washington Boulevard. Dr. Michael Monfus, he's the medical doctor over at that facility. I utilize my PA background to structure all these different components, because the doctors, I'm not just a healthcare professional, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm able to orchestrate all of these different opportunities, and the doctors trust me. That's what's important. They trust me to be their leader. They have medical sense. I got street sense. And you inspire me too, Mr. Frank. I promise you, you do, because to hear your story, and I'm working on two big projects. I'm working on a biopic for the Temprees and a biopic for the Barkays. They're not even in pre-production right now. We're trying to get connected with Unsung and get that story while they're still alive.
I know the people at Unsung.
That's what I'm saying. You and I, we can communicate out with this project.
Absolutely.
The Barkays and the Temprees have compelling stories. I grew up with them cats. They're older than I am, but for me to become their producer and keep them on venues while we're still performing. We had a big conversation about Unsung this weekend. We got to bring the Barkay story to life, the Temprees story to life, because they're still living. It was three of the Temprees. Jasper Philip Jabbo, he passed back in 1991. But the two originals, they're still living. We need to get their stories out while they're still living, so it won't have to be falsified. It can be a true story. And the Barkay, James Alexander, he's still living. Larry Dawson, he just retired from the Barkay 2 years ago, but the Barkay still live on. But Larry's story is still here as well. So these are all the things that God had put on my plate to fulfill throughout the lifespan that I'm living right to this day. And right now, we at the door knocking. Now, Stephen put us together, so good thing come together.
Always. Now let me ask you a question, Robert. Is James Alexander, was he one of the ones that was in the accident?
He wasn't in the accident because James missed that flight that Otis Redding and all the other Barkays was in.
Oh.
But James caught a different flight outside of the flight that crashed.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Larry Dawson survived. I think Larry survived the crash, but James Alexander was actually on a different flight. Now, keep in mind, Ben Cotley just expired 2 years ago. We're doing a story for his daughters about Ben Carlin. He was the founder of the Barkays, the founder. So right. James Alexander and Ben Carlin and all Otis Redding and all them, they played in the Barkay back in the day. Now, Larry Dawson, which was one of the lead singers of the Barkay, he was a Temprees singer before he became a Barkay. I was the executive producer of the Temprees 50th anniversary. And now we got them on the pay-per-view. The interview was at WDIA, one of the oldest radio stations, historic radio stations in Memphis with Deb Johnson. She just got inducted as one of the first female radio personality in the radio industry. I work with Stan Bell. He's over at V101. He's another good inspired radio personality out of Memphis, Tennessee. My girlfriend, I got to give a shout out to her because she's a music producer too. Her name is Verdiana Brody. Her and I, we linked up about 3 years ago, man. I tell you, it's nothing like having a person in your life that loves you and you can feel the love that has your back 100%. I have to give her kudos because I would never, ever do an interview without mentioning her. She's the backbone of Five Star Music Group Concert Series. I love her dearly.
One of the people that I want to introduce you to, Robert, Frank, you know him very well also, but he's from Memphis. He's a legend. No. Logan Westbrooks.
I didn't realize Logan was from Memphis, but yes.
He went to Booker T. Washington High School.
A lot of people that went to Booker T. Washington, they're celebrities now.
Logan Westbrook and that generation, like Larkin Arnold, Bill Strickland, all those guys, those who helped start Black Entertainment Sports Lawyers Association would be part of my mentorship. Those guys are 5 and 10 years older than I am. And I can't believe I'll be 70 in a few months.
Oh, man, congratulations. Yeah, I'll be 60 next month.
All right. Happy birthday. Right.
I'm with you, Frank.
Oh,
unfortunately.
Good. I knew you then, but I wasn't going to disclose your age. Yeah. Congratulations to all of us. And if God be willing, we'll have much more time to assist and help and mentor others. Certainly, I've learned a whole lot from you, Dr. Jameson. And whatever little I've been able to inspire you, I'm grateful. And Stephen, Thank you so much.
You gave me a history lesson. You just gave me a lesson.
When you get this old.
Dude, I haven't been through nothing compared to what you just put me up on today.
Oh, bless you. That you're so kind. Thank you so much.
I want to thank both of you all for being part of this show today. It's a very wonderful, inspiring show. And I thank you all. I want you all to come back on at another time.
Absolutely.
Well, privilege and pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. That's it for the show about Stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Stuff. I appreciate you all being here. And thank you so much, so very much. Absolutely. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to the stuff.
Thank you. God bless all of you. So
thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
Hello, my name is Jewel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is an author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!